My name's Coulter, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for asking me to come down. Heard a lot about this meeting. Driving down through Greene County, Madison, was thinking a lot about my family of origin, or people from Greene County. I'm a Knight, and my great-grandfather, we were talking about this before the meeting, my great-grandfather was a minister at the Evergreen Church of the Brethren. He married Shiflett, had seven kids, and one of those was my grandfather. And so my dad grew up on a farm right there at the mouth of Bacon Hollow. And I remember Dad telling me when I was a kid, my dad became a dentist. They moved into town. Dad went to the Navy and became a dentist, and he said, "Now, don't you tell anybody we're related to those Shiflets now." And somewhere in Greene County, I'm sure there's a Shiflett family saying, "No, don't you tell anybody we're related to those Knights." So I got a lot of kin folks all up around in that area, and it's just sort of in my blood. But I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, as described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I reached a point in my drinking where I lost the power of choice. I had no mental defense against taking the first drink. And the only reason I'm sober tonight is because the grace of God moved into my life, moved into my heart, and protects me from drinking. That's the only reason I'm sober tonight. And as sort of a disclaimer, as you read out of the big book, my story is my own story. If you're here, if you're new, relatively new, you don't identify with anything in my story, keep coming back. You'll hear somebody you identify with. But also have my beautiful daughter with me here tonight, my young daughter. It's the first time she's ever heard me speak. So, you know, we tell our story in a general way, so it's going to be very general tonight. So. But she's been an Alateen now for a while. Anyhow, so I grew up in Charlottesville. My father was a dentist. Neither my mom or dad were alcoholics. I had a wonderful childhood, you know, childhood that anyone could hope for. You know, provided for. I was a middle child. I had an older brother that partied a lot, but he's one of these weird people that just kind of outgrew it, and now he's a dentist, and I don't know how that happened. And a younger sister who doesn't not alcoholic is either. But I think my drinking was characterized by what I found in alcohol and what alcohol did for me. When I, you know, in retrospect, when I went back and started looking at my life, taking inventory, I was fraught with fear, and I developed a mental habit from as early as I can remember, of really responding to fear and being driven by fear, and really the net result was I avoided growing up emotionally. You know, I got to AA, I was a pretty emotionally immature individual. I had a tough time in school. I went to a private school. Robert E. Lee used to be up in Charlottesville. I repeated third grade because I didn't do very well in math. I had wasn't really diagnosed back then. I had attention deficit disorder, and they didn't really do much about it. My parents didn't do anything about it. I used to joke, I said, I just wasn't paying attention, really. That's what it was. But you know, I avoided tough things like the plague. I avoided confrontation. I avoided, only did things that I wanted to do when it came to homework. And, you know, so much of what I come to understand about myself, I didn't really learn about until I came to AA and started thinking back about it. I remember, let's talk about I remember one time I was at this keg party, and I was providing some outside issues at the party, and this girl that I knew, she was sitting next to me, she said, "Oh, Coulter, you're just so carefree. That's what I love about you." And And that hit me like a ton of bricks because it was not true at all. And nobody had ever said anything to me like that. I never thought about it, but I wasn't carefree. I was a damn nervous wreck all the time inside, except when I was drinking. But, you know, the first drink I ever had, I still remember very vividly, this kid in the neighborhood. I'd smoked some outside issues before I ever started drinking. I guess my first real addiction was smoking cigarettes. I'd get up and go out every morning, probably when I was 12 years old or something like that, I started smoking cigarettes. Both my parents smoked until the 70s, and then, you know, they figured out it was bad for them, so they just quit, and it took me forever to quit. But I would, I'd go out, sneak around the side of the house, and I'd go back in the corner, smoke a cigarette out of a pack that I'd stolen from Dad, and I'd hear him leave and go to work, and I did that every morning, and I couldn't wait to get home from school and smoke again. That was my first addiction. But this kid in the neighborhood, he had this thing where he'd go around, break into people's houses and steal their wine and stuff. And so we were out in the woods one day, and he asked if I wanted to drink. I said, okay, I'll try it. And he had this little thing built in the ground, like a little lid. It would open up and had like a fascinating. Anyway, so I drank, like a little hibachi refrigerator out there. But so what I remember from taking a drink was I still remember the trees. I remember the sky. I remember where it was, Virginia pine trees. And I just remember feeling really different. When I drank, the world looked different to me. I felt different about myself. I felt successful. I had courage. I had self-esteem. I had all this stuff. And I got that first taste for alcohol, and it was just inevitable for me right then. I loved it. I loved it. And the first, so that was, I didn't get drunk, but I had, you know, got a good little buzz going there. And so the first time I ever got drunk, I was alone. My parents had gone out to a basketball game. And my dad and mom were sort of, I call them liquor collectors. They never really drank a lot, but they would collect it because they would have so much left over from like a party, or someone would give them a gift and bring them some kind of sake or some kind of sweet, nasty stuff. The stuff with the wax melted around the top and whatever that is. And they would just never drink. They never drank around the house. And, once in a while they would have beer when they went out. So I got in, there was some vodka in there, and I'd never mixed a drink before, so I didn't really know what to do. So I got one of those UVA collectible glasses that you used to be able to get, and I filled it up about three-quarters of the way of vodka, and then I put orange juice and the rest of it, you know, mixed drink. I drank that, and then some more, and I remember standing in the front in the kitchen window hollering about how pissed off I was about the Vietnam War. And Nixon and the whole mess in Rich. And I had a cousin who was a helicopter gunner in Louisa. He survived, but he got shot up a whole bunch of times. But just this, all this rage came out of me. It was resentment, really, is what it was. But I felt this liberty, just ha. And I was by myself, and of course, talking to people that weren't there. And as Bim used to say, but next thing I know, I'm laying on the floor of my bedroom, and my mom is yelling upstairs for me to go to school. And I'm laying there, and this big old puddle of yellow puke all around my head, just in red carpet, and I had this wallpaper, Revolutionary Soldier wallpaper, and Coulter, it's time to go to school, I was just sick as a dog all day at school, drinking water, throwing up. But, man, I was going to return to that. I mean, I really dug that. And so I was really off to the races. I have a huge drug story. I'll just leave it out. This is AA. But that was something I sort of did along with alcohol. I guess from there, you know, things just started going downhill. I usually only partied on the weekends because I was just so restricted because my parents were very strict, and so I couldn't go out during the week. But I partied on the weekend, and things got worse and worse. I would steal money from my mother. She had this little place in her desk where she kept money. I'd pinch a 20 here, pinch a 20 there. You know, lying was just routine for me. I mean, I just lied all the time. And you know, one of the insanities, in my opinion, one of the insanities of step two when you start talking about insanity is when you believe your own lies. Is when you lie so much, you start to believe your own stuff. So anyhow, didn't do very well in high school. I just barely graduated. Probably 2 weeks before I left, you know, the principal Ben Hurt called home and told me I was going to make it. I got out of high school, and then that's really when things really. I started working, and going to Piedmont and partying, and but I have this thing that I found that I want to read. I found some time ago. I was reading this book, and I found something that really fit me really well, and it shocked me. But I'm going to read this little thing. Maybe some of you identify with some of what's in here. And or maybe not. But this is a personality profile of a guy. Says he was an isolated type of human being. He was highly individualistic and chose to grow into a confirmed and shut-in and unsociable sort of person. As a child, life had been made too easy for him. He bitterly resented thwarting. He always expected to win. He was a very poor loser. He never acquired a philosophic technique for meeting disappointment. Instead of accepting disappointments as a regular and commonplace feature of human existence, he unfailingly resorted to the practice of blaming someone in particular or his associates as a group for all of his personal difficulties and disappointments. He was given to holding grudges. He was always entertaining the idea of revenge. He did not like to face facts frankly. He was dishonest in his attitude toward life situations. He disliked to discuss his personal problems with his immediate associates. He refused to talk over his difficulties with his real friends and those who truly loved him. He never learned that real rewards of noble living are, after all, spiritual prizes, which are not always distributed during this one short life in the flesh. As a result of his persistent isolation of personality, his griefs multiplied, his sorrows increased, his anxieties augmented, and his despair deepened almost beyond endurance. While this self-centered and ultra-individualistic apostle had many psychic, emotional, and spiritual troubles, his main difficulties were in personality. He was isolated. In mind, he was suspicious and vengeful. In temperament, he was surly and vindictive. Emotionally, he was loveless and unforgiving. Socially, he was unconfiding and almost wholly self-contained. In spirit, he had become arrogant and selfishly ambitious. In life, he ignored those who loved him. And in death, he was friendless. That's a profile of Judas the betrayer. And I read that along with the other 12 profiles of the apostles one time. Whether it's really his profile or not, for us, anyone to say, but it was my profile. It hit me square between the eyes. And it gave me some understanding of him when I saw that. And so that just fits my inventory so well, I include that in my talk, and maybe some other people may identify with that. So you mixed a little alcohol with that personality right there. And so, anyway, so I'm out of high school. I had my first, woke up in the morning, I was shaking, I was having DTs. I'd been at Sloan's all night, got thrown at Mrs. Sloan, threw me out of Sloan's. And so my parents put me in David C. Wilson. It used to be a hospital called David C. Wilson in Charlottesville. And I remember being really, you know, checking me in there. And I had this peculiar belief about myself, but I really understood the inner workings of my mind. I understood my psychology. And I was concerned. I was always really suspicious of psychiatrists and counselors. I thought they messed people up. And so this guy was checking me into the hospital, and his name was Derek, and he was asking me all these really deep questions like, what's your address, what's your social security number? And I was just hostile to him. You know, how often do you drink and things like that. And that night, I used to sleep in the nude. And that night, I remember that somebody came in my room and got mad at me for sleeping. And you got to put some clothes on. You know, it's the hospital. You can't do that. So the next morning, I went to, they were having a group. It was like the first time I'd been to a group, like an AA type of group. And there was some guy was leaving that day, and he was so happy, and he was on something. There was something about a pink cloud. I remember that. And my honest feeling was that while this is good for these people, I'm a special case, you know. I'm a special case. I just sort of levitate a little bit, of just a little bit smarter than anybody. And this clearly is not for me. And what's frightening about that is I really sincerely believe that, you know. It wasn't like I knew the truth and was lying about myself, but I just felt like I don't have a problem like this. Not that bad. And so then later I remember talking it must have been a couple hours with Dr. Goodnow about my drinking, and he used all different kinds of techniques and to try to break my denial or whatever he was up to. And I said, look, I'm signed up to go to school in Richmond in a couple weeks, and I can't do your 28-day program. You know, this has all been very scary for me, and I don't want to drink anymore. Maybe I'll get out and I'll look into something AA or whatnot. And so I talked my way out. They couldn't hold me in there. I called my dad. My dad came and got me, and so I went off to school in Richmond, dental lab school. And so I quit drinking for about 6 months on my own. I did other things, though. I was always so proud of myself. I do all these kind of outside issues at night and then wake up the next day and be really glad I didn't drink. So proud of myself I didn't drink. But the day came when some of the second-year students were having a Halloween party, and all day I didn't really realize about what I was planning to drink. I had this euphoric feeling, and I was all pumped up and excited. And so when they stopped by the liquor store, I just sort of went right on with them, just like, you know, and there's a little voice in the back of my head, are you sure? And I went right on in with them and got my Jack Daniels and drunk and did something, offended the person that was having the party that night. So I was back at it again, and then I'd stop for a week on my own, and I'd go back to it. And anyway, so we were three of us living in this apartment on Paramount Broad, and all of us were going to school. And we had this great idea of moving this cocaine dealer in with us from Charlottesville. And that really, I would go for a couple days with no sleep, drinking, no sleep, no food. And your head just gets really messed up. But I started a series of just real insane behavior. I remember one time, you know, you'd be up all night, you run out of beer, and I always kind of combine, you know, drinking and other things. And so you run out of the other thing, and you run out of beer, and you couldn't wait till 6 in the morning for the store to open up on the corner of Paramount Broad. And, you know, you're just like sitting in the parking lot just waiting, you know. It's like 5:59, you know, 6. And so you go in there and they're taking the chains off the doors. And I'd grab a 6-pack, but I had this thing in my head. I didn't want the lady who worked there, I would see her all the time. I was in and out of the store all the time. I didn't want her thinking I was drinking at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I'd buy other things to go along with my beer, you know, pencils, you know, paper. To try to project a story that he's not really going to drink these tall boys at 6 in the morning. He's going to school, and then there's going to be a picnic or something after school, and he's just that's what he's doing. And I distinctly remember seeing other guys that get like contractors in line, they're on the way to the job, and they're buying 40s. And I thought how sad that was. These guys are going to drink that on the way to the job. And I go back home to my apartment and drink, and look out the window all paranoid, and I'd see all my neighbors are doing, you know, they're living right. You look out the window and people are coming out with their coffee and getting their paper and going to work. And here I was wired out and paranoid in my apartment with no sleep. And another kind of a bizarre thing that I did. So I'd spend up, my dad would send me a check for rent and for food, but, you know, I would blow it all. And so I wouldn't have, so I ran out of money. And so I'm sitting in my apartment one day, and our apartment door had one of those things where the mail slot, the mail would come in. And I'm sitting there, and y'all, some of y'all remember Best Products, the place where you go in and you wouldn't take things off the shelf. You'd have to fill out a form, and then you take and put the form in its tube, and it go up somewhere, and then they send it out the back. It's weird. But this circular came through, and Best was having all this big sale, and it was all this stuff that I'd always wanted, but I didn't have any money. But it was on sale. So I went to Best, and I bought a stereo cabinet and a dustbuster and a cordless phone. There's all those things, the things I'd always wanted. But I wrote about $285 bad check. And I went home, I put the stereo cabinet together, and blah, blah, blah. And I remember my roommates coming home, and they just thought I was so pathetic. They were just laughing at me because they knew I didn't have any money. And you know, how are you gonna deal with that floated check out there? And so I thought, all right. So the next morning I felt up, and I woke up and I was having this horrible remorse and fear about what I was going to do. So I took back the stereo cabinet. I took that all back apart. Took the stereo cabinet and the cordless phone back, but I kept the dustbuster. And I went back, and then I realized, you know, what I'll do is I'll just get cash back for this stuff. And so I got cash back, and I went and blew all that, and I still had the check floating out there. So I called Dad, and I said, Dad, the car broke down, and the carburetor had to be rebuilt. Can you send me some money? And he was very suspicious of that. But he said, I'll send it to you, but I want a receipt. I want a receipt for the auto repair place. So, oh, sure. So he sent the money, put the money in the mail. And so I had to figure out how the hell am I going to come up with a receipt? So I got this idea. I dressed up my coat and tie, and I went up to the gas station up on Broad. And I went in there, and I told the guy, I said, hey, look, I'm taking a class at VCU, and we're studying invoices. And I need a blank invoice. And he just looked at me and said, get the hell out of here. Those things are all numbered. You can't have a blank invoice. And so I was so crushed at my con job didn't work very well. And so I heck with that. So that was something that was sort of outstanding. So somehow I got to a place where I picked the phone up and I called the hotline in Richmond, the Intergroup up there. And I guess it was a answering service. It wasn't, you know, I was expecting a little more fanfare when I called in. It was like they were waiting for me to call in. I was crying. I don't have a problem. I really don't. And she said, well, there's a meeting down at the end of gas generator. It's 7:30. Go down there. So anyway, she accidentally sent me to a woman's meeting. And so I got going to church. I'm looking around, and I didn't know what to expect. One door I could tell they weren't really alcoholic-looking people. They were like the choir or something. And anyway, so I looked around for about 30 seconds, and I turn around. I went back out in the parking lot. We get in the car, and here comes this little girl walking along, and she said, "Are you looking for an AA meeting?" And I said, yeah, I don't know what it was about me that she thought I was looking for an AA meeting. I mean, why? Maybe I was just leaving choir early, but no. She's looking for AA. Yeah. I said, well, this is a women's meeting, but there's one right down the road, the Greenwood Group. And I tell you what, I'll take you down there. So she put me in her car, and she was new, and she was mumbling something about how she was going to tell her sponsor about this. And you know, I just all I knew, I had sweaty palms, and I just was like nervous. So I went to my first AA meeting. It was one of the most important days of my life. They were studying the big book that night. I don't know what they were reading. I had my antennas up, you know, if I heard any kind of preachy stuff, because I just didn't know what to expect. You know, I'd never been to AA before. In fact, I'll tell you, the first time I ever heard of AA, I was hungover one day in class at Piedmont, and I was having a smoke in between class, and there was this little girl that lived down the street from me. She was like 5 or 6 years older than us. She was, I remember her, she was like a hippie from the 60s. She used to always wander around with tie-dye stuff on. And she had a real quiet voice. And we're smoking a cigarette. And I was complaining about how I was hungover. And she just said one thing. She said, I go to AA. And that's all she said. and it was the perfect thing to say for me. I was like, she might as well have been screaming with a bullhorn, "You got a drinking problem!" But that's, you know, she wasn't. She's, "I go to AA." I mean, what was I going to say? "No, you don't go to AA." But I mean, it's great. It's great. That's all you got to say. You don't have to give, you don't tell your whole story and tell chapter 5 or anything. Just, "I go to AA." And so that little seed was planted inside of me, and I heard it, and we didn't say anything else about that, but it was in my head. So that's where I, you know, was first introduced into this idea of AA. So I get there to the Greenwood group. They were studying the Big Book. I heard, I don't know what they were studying, but I heard the word. To me, I call this the Word of God written for alcoholics. That's what I call it. And so I heard something in there, and more importantly, I perceived a sincerity in the people. They weren't phony. They spoke a language that was very straightforward. They cared. After the meeting, they didn't come up and try to, you know, do anything to make me join up. I picked a white chip up. They gave me some pamphlets after the meeting. They gave me some cookies. And that was it. And it was a great experience. I went home. I read that pamphlet, and I was ready to teach it. You know, I worked all the 12 steps right there that night. And a couple of weeks later, I was drunk again. And then so I went back. I didn't know what to expect. They're going to be upset with me. But they were like, almost as if they were expecting it. And so I went back, and they gave me another white chip. And then not long after that, about a month later, I got drunk again. And, you know, I didn't go like every day. I didn't get any kind of sponsor or anything like that. Those were my visits. But all those were necessary for me to crush my ego, to get to the place where it happened. And I was in my apartment in Richmond, and it was a day like any other day. I was miserable. I was worrying, anxious. A lot of my thought life as a practicing alcoholic was kind of a combination of worrying and daydreaming. That's sort of what I did all the time. I worried and I daydreamed, worried about something I did yesterday, worried about something in the future. And that's really, I did so much of that. And one morning, I had the windows, I put towels over the windows because I hated seeing the sun come up in the morning when I'd been wired out all night. It was such a guilty feeling to hear these, the songbirds are all going, and, you know, the damn sun. And yeah, I just hated that. I wanted to stay nighttime. And so I was sitting there in my room, and one moment, the only way I can describe it is just putting words to it, because there really no words went through my head. One moment I had no hope, and the next moment I had hope. That's what happened. That's the best way to describe it. I completely switched teams. I mean, I just completely switched. I was somebody who often was very argumentative with religion, with God, with spirituality. I had a basic belief, you know, like the Big Book talks about deep down every side of it, you know, we all have this kind of basic belief. But I had a lot of hostility towards growing up in a moderate Christian church. Just all that stuff really creeped me out. But I became open-minded. You know, I became willing to listen. You know, the saying, "When the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear." Well, that's what happened to me. I became willing to cooperate. I became willing to ask for help. But I never asked another soul for help with any personal problem. "I would need a help me. Can you lend me $20? You know, that kind of help. Can you help me fix this thing I broke or get me out of this trouble?" But I never went to somebody and said, "You know, I'm full of fear. I'm just full of fear. And I don't know why. I'm just afraid of every damn thing." I never did that. You know, I never talked to people about what was really going on inside of me. I didn't even know what was really going on inside of me. That, you know, there's a saying that alcoholics are always the last one to know what's really going on in their own life. You know, everybody else knows, but not me. So that was April 28, 1985. I've not had a drink or a drug since then, since that day in my apartment. Had a lot of chocolate cake. I got other kind of things, but no illegal drugs. And so I called home. I told my mother. My father was at the point where he wasn't speaking to me. You know, he just was so tired of my crap and my lies and that whole thing about the money was outstanding. And he just was disgusted with me. And, you know, people get, we wear people out. You know, we just wear people out. And it's no wonder. So I went to Mountainwood Treatment Center, which isn't here anymore. I was grateful to be there. It was based on, fortunately, it was based on AA. Some of the principals there were AA people. So the whole thing, they gave you the whole stack of literature. They gave you the big book, 12 and 12. Back then it was Little Black 24-Hour from Hazelden. And it was all based on AA. And you were expected to take the first five steps before you left there. And so I did. I did my first inventory when I was there. And they had this crazy thing where you did your inventory in front of all the other inmates, and then they would analyze you, and it was just a real sick mess. But anyway, that was my first, you know, first attempt at an inventory. Then I got out. I got a sponsor right away. I went to meetings every day. I did another inventory probably within 3 months of getting out. And I remember one night I was having dinner with my parents, and it was just my mom and dad and myself, and sitting there, and, you know, I've been going to meetings every day and just all of that, and they were real quiet, and my mother spoke up, and she said, you've had like a 95% change in your personality. We don't even recognize you. Oh, really? You pass the taters? You know, I didn't know that. You know, that's how profound the change was. I did not know that. I did not set out for that to happen. I just made a huge mess of my life and was reborn. And so Dad said, yeah, you really are just very different than you used to be. And I said, wow. So anyway, so I just kept going to meetings. And I picked up my one-year chip, and I got home, and I got a phone call from these detectives in Richmond who had been part of a grand jury investigation concerning things that we were doing there in Richmond and Charlottesville and whatnot. And so they asked me to come down and talk to them in Richmond, in a hotel room. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And didn't get any legal advice. So because I didn't, you know, I don't know, what do they want to talk to me about? So we're sitting there, and they started asking me questions, and I realized from the questions they were asking me, they knew the answers already. And so basically what they were trying to do is put together a kingpin case to connect five people together for a kingpin trafficking case. That's what they were after. And so I had to, you know, be honest about my part. And so, long story short, 2 years later, subsequently after I graduated from school, I went back to school, commuted, I finished, graduated on like the dean's list, which was incredible. Got a dental laboratory degree, moved down to Roanoke, and so it was about at 2 years that I was convicted and given of drug trafficking, and convicted and given 4 years federal, and it was in federal court. 4 years federal probation. Thankfully, I'd never had any charges before. There was a guy in my home group in Roanoke who was a Barry Kay. He was a detective with the state police. He wrote Judge J. Harry Michael a nice letter. Yeah, he's going to meetings, he's clean, blah, blah. Had some other people testify on my behalf. And so I ended up 4 years probation. I wouldn't have fared very well in federal prison, really. Wouldn't fare very well in any prison, but. And, you know, some of the other people ended up doing some, you know, the people who were, they were still using, still partying, still doing all this stuff, ended up doing some really hard time, 10 years. But during that time, I got it would have been my third sponsor, Bud, an old timer down the road. And he is the guy that I credit as really giving me my AA theology. The way I think about AA, he sponsored using the book, and the way I picked him, you know, I'd heard about him when I moved down there, and, you know, Gloria used to say, Gloria was my mother-in-law, she's spoken here before, and she was recommending I get a sponsor, and I think she's pushing me in that direction, but she said, you know, down there they would say, well, what you want to do, you want to pick the real son of a bitch in the meeting, that's what you want to do, you want to pick the guy that everybody hates. You know, the guy is always talking about working his steps and stuff. Pick that guy. funny saying, but so Bud was there on the front row one night. He always sat up on the front row, and Bud was kind of funny. He's kind of eccentric. He always looked like he was dressed for a safari. He always had like a safari vest on and a little beanie, and he had like a pocket full of pens and like a thing to check your air pressure with and a thermometer. And he probably had some battery cables, and he's just an unusual guy, but. and he had cards. Bud would write down things that he heard in meetings that he liked, and he wanted to remember them. And he would talk about how in his first year of sobriety, he couldn't get to work without his thinking going downhill. So he always kept something to think other than the way he thought. So he had these. So anyway, so Bud's sitting there in the front row, and Bud had missing part of his index finger. He had this nub, and he always drank these Diet Coke. He'd been drinking his Diet Coke, and he's sitting there, and he listened to my story, and I talked about, you know, I had this just feelings of inferiority all my life. And so after the meeting, Bud came up, good talk, and he said, he looked at me right in the eye, he said, you don't have an inferiority complex, you're just inferior. And then he laughed, and I laughed, and it was great. I knew exactly what he was saying, and so he became my sponsor, and so we went back through. I'd already done two inventories, and he said, "Okay," he sat me down and said, "Use the book. I want you to go home and write down the first three things that you'd never tell another soul, and come tell them to me." And it kind of pissed me off a little bit because I've been sober a couple of years now. Why was he assuming there were three things I had that I didn't tell another soul? Well, I knew immediately what they were right away, just like that. Three things, boom, popped right into my head that I had never told anybody on any of those other inventories. And so I did that, and that was the beginning of a solid relationship. Somebody that I really looked up to, that I had a lot of respect for, and he's been dead a long time. He died at 52 years of sobriety, and that was a while back, but I have a sponsor today, but he sort of still sponsors me in the back of my head. I'm always thinking the things that Bud said. So anyway, so I did my 4 years. I continued to go to meetings in Roanoke, had a home group, always had a sponsor. When I got sober, the idea of coming to AA was, first of all, the acceptance is this is something you're going to have to do the rest of your life. You will go to meetings the rest of your life. That's just what you do. There's not a time in sobriety where you don't. So I got married to somebody I met in AA. We dated I'll just cover this real quick. We dated for 5 years before we got married. After we were married 5 years, we had children. And after we were married 20 years, we got divorced. And I have three beautiful children. My youngest is here, 22-year-old daughter, 21-year-old son. And my 22-year-old daughter's got 9 months now, sobriety. I was a little baby. She went through a terrific time. So much like me, I tell you, when I guess growing up with two AA parents is like growing up in family with your dad's a preacher or something. I mean, it's just so difficult. But she's turned the corner. Anyway, I started a business down in Roanoke, a dental laboratory, moved that back up to Charlottesville, back in 91. Life was good. Became successful in my business, so to speak. My wife worked, and so we had a really good living. So at about probably, I think it's important to cover this, probably at about 18 years in, I never thought it would happen to me, because I'm just so enthusiastic about AA, but I just slowly stopped going to meetings. And it's funny, it's like they say your thinking changes like the small hand, small hand on the clock. You know it moves, but you can't see it moving. You just basically you start to unwork the 12 steps. You stop working with others, you stop praying and meditating very much, you stop taking personal inventory, you stop admitting you're wrong, because you're never wrong, right? You just sort of undo everything. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, one, and so I was maybe going to meet. We moved outside of town to this little golfing community, and I was playing golf about every day. I'd leave work at 4 o'clock and go out there, and I could hit nine holes for dinner. And then I'd be tired. I don't want to drive back into town. And so I was going to maybe one meeting every 2 weeks. And so then I was at the Saturday morning meeting, As Bill Sees It meeting, actually, that we started back in 1986. And there was a guy there announcing that there's a group of us that's going to work the Big Book together using Dr. Paul's format. And I thought, well, this would be a good thing for me to do. And so that doing that, going through, following the format with a group of people, working back through the 12 steps again, kind of reinvigorated my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. And since then, I've done it again. If anybody's never done it, it's really a fantastic thing to do. It's amazing. You really get close to the people that you do that with, that you take the steps with, and you're expected to do an inventory. You're expected to do all 12 steps. And so that format's on the internet. If anybody wants to ever look it up. And so that just sort of redid my sobriety. Probably one of the more difficult things in my life, it's really still going on with my divorce. I'm sure if anybody's ever here, you've experienced it. Primarily because of the effect on my children. And that was, stone cold sober, facing life on life's terms. And I think, I remember one of the feelings that I had was, God, well, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, now I'm divorced. So I'm adding another label to myself. And, there's a sense of failing somehow, am I not working the program right? What's wrong with me? That was a tough one. And so I've lost both my mom and dad in sobriety, and none of those even came close to it. I remember being with my dad when he died, and it was a good experience for me because fear of death, it's weird. We have a fear of death, but there's a saying that the 12 steps are a path to salvation from self. They are a path to salvation from self, from the self-destructive alcoholic. And I remember being with my dad all of his life. He's been kind of a worrier. It's one of his things. He's always worried about little things. He's up there at UVA Hospital, and he had one of those masks on. It was forcing air in, and all the family and his people were there. And he'd sleep a little bit, and he'd come to me and say, order some parts for the car. And he'd say, Dad, we'll get the parts for the car. And, he knew he was dying, but he died, and it was a good experience for me to be able to pass through, and I don't have quite the fear of death that I used to have. There was a guy one time that said something. God, he said it years ago. Mike C. said it. And something is funny. You hear things in meetings, you just remember them all your life. He said, it's not that we don't have problems anymore. We just have a better quality of problems than we used to have. For me, it used to be, how am I going to pay the drug dealer back? Or how am I going to know about that check I'm floating and that money I stole? And now it's, making the mortgage payment, making the tax payroll for my business because business slowed way down in 2008. And it's been difficult recovering from that. So I guess where I'm going with that is I've had some of the hardest times in my life in sobriety. Some of the hard times I had as a drunk were the artificial problems that I kept creating, the sickness of being hungover. When I drank, my hangovers, I felt like I had the flu. I'd go a few days with no sleep. I'd be all dehydrated, and it's just like, it's just horrible, horrible. So I had those kind of complicated problems, but I had new problems that come with a life of relating to other human beings and having children and being married and divorced and just different things, you know, different things come up, but, you know, we just keep going through the 12 steps. We keep sticking with the program. You know, I think I'm going to say this in close. When I went to, one of the things that concerned me when I was in that first year, I mean, that first month or two of getting out of treatment, I remember being in the shot in the dark meeting. I've always suffered from brief enthusiasms. I get real, real excited about something. I'm all in that one thing, and then it just kind of fades off, and I move on to the next thing. You know, like a diet. You go on a diet, you're all about, you know, you're telling everybody about your stupid diet. Nobody wants to hear about it. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's like you're, you know, stuffing your face. You're like, what about that diet? You oh, it's kind of lame. And so I was afraid that that my sobriety in AA was going to be like that. That this was just one of my brief enthusiasms. That was one of the fears that I had. And I was sitting at the Shot in the Dark meeting, and they were reading How It Works. And, you know, you hear that so often. Unfortunately, we read it so much. It's one of the most profound parts of the book, the instructions. We read it so often, we've worn it out. No one's listened to it when they're reading it. But I was sitting there, and it said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And so the saying is, find out what the path is and stick with it. And, you know, if you're all in AA, you know you're all in. If you're not all in, then get all in. That's the last thing I have to say. Thank you very much for asking me to come speak.